Welcome to the Design Systems Podcast. We're all about the places where design and development overlap. We talk with the industry experts about trends in design, development, and take a look at new ways to build digital experiences, typically over a beer or two. Hey, and welcome to the Design Systems Podcast. Today, we're talking with Jeremy Keith. He's one of the founders of Clear Left. I met him first at an event apart in San Francisco back in December. He had a great conference talk there about progressive web applications. And I thought it would be a really interesting chat with him to talk about design system, progressive web apps, and sort of how the modern web is evolving. Welcome, Jeremy.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, stoked to have you on. So just kind of kicking things off, talk to me a little bit about how design systems are a part of your life right now. What are you doing with these things? How are you working on with them? You'd mentioned some writing that you're doing. Give me a little bit of background on where you're coming from here.
Well, at Clear Left, we've been sort of involved in design systems from kind of before we were using the term design systems. Many years ago, one of our developers, Natalie Down at the time, she started to organize deliverables into patterns. She called it a pattern portfolio. I guess now we call it a pattern library. This idea of componentization, this was years before, you know, React or any of those kind of things. And we just found that as an agency delivering things in terms of code, delivering components gave us more bang for our buck than delivering a finished, say, set of pages or a whole product. That it was kind of like giving the client, teaching them how to fish rather than giving them a fish, you know, it's like giving them all the tools they need to make more pages and different products.
Right. So moving from that page-based model was some, you know, evolution that a lot of us kind of felt and went through, you know, 5, maybe 6 years ago, where we started to understand that maybe throwing around Photoshop files, layered PSDs, and trying to infer, you know, how to build a page over and over and over again was something that was maybe not the right way to build all this stuff. And so it sounds like your evolution was similar to that, where you started to look at pattern libraries as a way of sort of streamlining this and helping clients sort of help themselves in this delivery process. Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, it's interesting because I think these days when you see examples of pattern libraries in the wild, they're generally made by product people, right? Some company that's got an ongoing digital product or service, and the design system, the pattern library is this part of that. Whereas where we were using them historically was as a deliverable. As in, we're an outside agency. We've been hired by somebody, and we're handing over the result of design, which is often code, you know. And we'd be giving a pattern library as a deliverable. Now, ideally, you'd hope that they take that pattern library and keep it alive and evolve it. But honestly, I've come to see over time that if you're delivering a pattern library as a deliverable, then I don't think it'll be maintained afterwards. It's more like it's a one-off thing. It's still the most efficient way to deliver the code. But I've come to believe that if you want a living style guide, a living pattern library, then the people who will be living with it need to be involved in the creation of it.
And so it's more than just good governance, because like Brad Frost, for example, he talks a lot about how important governance models are to creating design systems that withstand the test of time. And so you think that actually like a hand in that creation process is also very important to that, you know, longevity or use of that pattern library.
Very much so. If people feel they're being told, here are the patterns you have to use, you're going to naturally rebel against that, right? But if you feel like you've got some investment in it, like, oh, I was involved in the creation of these patterns, then it's going to be a very different feeling. And that can be, you know, not just developers or designers, but, you know, everyone could get involved. For example, at the naming stage, just what are we calling these things? That's a great opportunity to bring everybody into the room, you know, people from the marketing department, people from, you know, everywhere, and run exercises purely around what would you call this thing? What would you name this? And you get agreement on that. And then so then when it emerges out the other end as code, as a visual design, people will recognize and go, oh, yes, I know what that means. I was involved in the creation of that. And there's this feeling of shared ownership. It's a much different feeling than being told from on high, here are the commandments of the design system that you must adhere to.
And I agree. I think that shared language creates these just incredible moments between people of like, oh, you called that a film strip? I called that a carousel for years. You know, people have these kind of aha moments of getting it and why it's important.
Yeah, we've got a little sort of game we play with that. Well, like I say, we get people in the room, basically just need, you need to print out, if let's say it's an existing product, an existing website, you know, do the sort of inventory you'd normally do of kind of identifying the patterns. Print them out and cut them up and arrange them, group them together. And then you have everyone with like post-it notes and Sharpies. And it's almost like poker where you say, okay, now we're going to each write down what we would call this thing. And on the count of three, we're all going to show our post-it notes. And you go one, two, three. And if everyone's written the same thing, that's it. Great. Solved. Move on to the next component. But if people have written different things, it's like, oh, that's interesting. Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Now, why did you call that? And even if someone doesn't end up, you know, if their idea doesn't end up being the final name, at least they had their say. You know, they were consulted.
That's hilarious. I could totally see like a side bet pool on, you know, that guy's going to call that thing a button. And then someone's like, you know, I got $5 or €5 on that other guy calling it a CTA. Anyway, thinking a little bit more about how these things actually then impact users. One of the things that we've been talking a lot about and thinking a lot about is this idea of how we design. When we talk about design systems and their impact, and a lot of the focus ends up being on these internal teams where you want to try to make these people excited and happy and enthusiastic about a design system. But ultimately, this is all in service of users. And so when thinking about that, how do you create the right things in your design system that ultimately serve users, not just other product owners?
First of all, I guess establishing what we mean by design system. We're talking about the final patterns, you know, maybe like I say, a pattern library, the components, the things that emerge out the other end. They are the final product of a much longer process,
right,
which is the design process in general. And by design, I don't mean just visual design of how things look. And I'm not talking about this movement from, say, a graphics design tool into code. I'm talking about way before that. That's where the work happens in terms of figuring out, are we designing the right thing? You know, there's the classic thing of the double diamond diagram where the second diamond is them building the thing right. And I think that's where pattern libraries and these kind of processes come in. But before you even get to that, you've got building the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that this is the right component to even be designing, much less turning it into code and putting it live? And so for that, you go all the way back to, you know, you got your discovery phases, you got your research, you've got all the UX processes and things in place. And a lot of that is about, you begin in a state of little knowledge and you're trying to increase knowledge. It's kind of like fighting entropy, I guess. You think you begin in a state of this chaos, you don't know what the right thing to do is, and you must narrow that down. You must generate order out of that chaos and sort of narrow in on a solution for a particular component, a particular pattern. And so that's where most of the work is, I think, really.
So what are some techniques that you use to put order to chaos?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, this is basically the entire design process. Like I said, there's research, usually, if we're talking about changes to an existing product, then research is the way to go. You want to get out there and talk to real users. There's all different research techniques there. If you're talking about something where it doesn't exist yet, and we're talking about the inventing something new, research is not always the right tool there, because then you're probably going to be asking hypothetical questions. Would you like this? Can you imagine that? That's not always what research is best at. So there we got tools like the design sprint, where, you know, within 5 days, we will generate a bunch of ideas, narrow in on one, prototype it, test it. So depending on whether you're talking about an existing product or something being created completely fresh, there are different tools for that. And then generally, projects with us, we're coming in as an outside agency. There's this discovery phase, which begins with us not providing any solutions. Quite the opposite. It's much more that the client is offloading onto us and telling us everything they know, telling us, you know, the knowledge we need. It's weirdly a kind of good position to be in, because we can ask the stupid questions. We can ask the questions at that point that maybe when they're so close to the thing, they don't even think about asking. Or they've got assumptions. They've always assumed that users want this and users believe that, but maybe there isn't anything to back that up. And we can point that out and say, well, this sounds like something we need to research. This sounds like something that needs to be tested. And it kicks off from there.
No, that's a great point. And in thinking about, you know, some of the challenges that we face when we're building design systems and when we're building like large web applications is when you look at this customer vision for what it is, often that vision is pretty far flung, where you have this like happy path of a user that has one of the latest devices with a modern browser with great stable broadband internet, and they're able to do like, you know, 80 animated SVGs on the same page and everything like that. And I think a lot of what we try to do is challenge those assumptions around that happy path and understand more about users that maybe aren't on that happy path, or even develop techniques like progressive enhancement that help us manage to create that experience for all of those users, not just that one group that seems exciting or new.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I'm kind of obsessed with the idea of progressive enhancement, and I'd be really interested to see it work combined with design systems. Because again, what tends to happen is a design system sort of gets unveiled when it's all done and everything's complete and everything's sort of finished. I would love it if to see a design system or pattern library go through that progressive enhancement process. We begin with literally a sketch on the back of a napkin, mm-hmm. and we've got that as that's the component to begin with. And maybe then it's turned into just pure text as interface. Just pure, here's the text that will be on the screen. And then maybe that's enhanced. Okay, well, now we choose the right HTML elements. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and this whole time, this is an entire system of components going through this. I think it'd be really fascinating to treat components as things that are being layered on. And because then what you'll end up with is a more robust component at the end of it.
There was a book, Sarah Veselov wrote it. And one of the really cool tenets of that that I was super excited to see was this idea of like, how do you construct these components from their basic parts? And it was like a radical take on atomic design, right? Where like when we're talking about atoms there, we're talking about, okay, so you have a grid system and then you have color fills and then you have text and then you have an icon and that creates a button. If you think about layering all those different things together, you know, you have these very basic bits that you can construct any experience from them. And that is kind of at the core of progressive web enhancement, where you think of these very basic elements constructed together to form these broader components.
Yeah, very much so. The way I like to talk about HTML, choosing the right HTML element, is that the HTML is like the subatomic particles of your design system. Before you even start putting the atoms together, making that decision about, is this a list item or mm-hmm. is this a link or is it a button? That's an even more fundamental decision to make.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of basis in reality for that as we're emerging with things like React Native and you know, other languages that look at primitives as a way of also crossing platforms. Because one of the challenges in design systems right now is that, you know, they're very, very functional and very fluid for web mediums, but native apps has always been one of those sticky points, right? So how do you create a component library for a native app that also works for the web?
Yeah, I think the idea of design tokens, you know, very much speaks to that, that Gene has been talking about, where, again, you say, yeah, it's like you're abstracting it away. You're breaking it down to its fundamental nature, like what is the value of this particular thing, regardless of whether it's going to end up on the web or native.
How do you then think about the construction of those things? Like, you know, we're theorizing a little bit here, right? Where, mm-hmm. you know, instead of starting with some high fidelity comp, you start with some lo-fi thing that is back of a napkin. And then you look at all of its constructible pieces. And at the end, you're given this component that has all of these layers to it that are like those primitives or those subatomic parts to it. You know, what do you think that then looks like in production?
You get something going at the most suitable level of fidelity for that component, the minimum viable fidelity, shall we say, mm-hmm. and then get it into users' hands in some way and test. And so what might end up happening is you get a component from the back of the napkin into text, into HTML, maybe a bit of CSS. And at that point, you think, this is actually ready to test, find a way of testing it, you know, quick and dirty guerrilla user testing with people, and maybe you find out, actually, this component isn't going to be the right solution, mm-hmm. and you cut off that particular avenue of exploration, and you go back and figure out a better component. And you've saved yourself the effort then. Or, on the other hand, if it turns out that it is the right component, then you've got validation, right? Less unknown, more knowledge.
Yeah, that's actually really exciting. That thought, like you mentioned the design sprint earlier, I have an idea for a component. I'm going to go through a really fast design iteration that you know, uses some design tools, ideates a little bit, does some exploration, and then, you know, picks a direction. And ultimately, you build that component and you build it in a very basic way based on that prototype. And maybe that prototype actually exists in the design system as, you know, something that never had like a full comp for it or whatever. And then you go out and you have a very lean process by which you test that component against actual users and get a really quick understanding about, is this reusable bit that I've created, is this pattern the right choice for our user base?
Yeah, I think it'd be a fascinating process, you know, to have that those findings in the system itself. Like, hey, this component is good for X and Y, but not Z. We know this because we ran this design sprint. Here's the findings from that design sprint. I really like it when design systems have research baked in, when they've got the documentation that says, we found that this is good for this scenario, not so good for that scenario, and here's the data or here's the findings to back that up. I know that gov.uk, they've got, you know, research in the system, and Bulb, the energy company here, they've got that as well. And I think that's really great, because if you're a designer or a developer trying to pick from the pattern library, trying to choose, is this the right component for me to use for my situation right now? That kind of research, those kind of findings are really valuable.
Yeah. And I mean, thinking about that on the other side of the coin too, right? When you think about like what insights can I gain from the use of this component, it wouldn't be particularly difficult to add some sort of analytics data into a design system as well to supplement that research. So I have this research data that is there, and then I also have insights about, you know, ongoing use in the wild for this particular component. And those things paired together, you could make some really interesting decisions around which components are effective for which user segments, if you want to do something like personalization, for which content audiences. So if you want to think about an accessibility need or a low bandwidth need or anything else like that, or even thinking about it in terms of like machine learning, right? You could have the design system actually recommend design treatments to a developer.
Yeah, although I have to say I'm always a little wary when it comes to the quantitative analytics like that, quantitative research, because I think the trick is finding that balance, right, between the qualitative stuff where you're speaking to users, you're testing things with them, and the quantitative where it's, okay, we've got the data, analytics, this kind of stuff, because analytics can be very seductive, and they can lead you down paths like, oh, it's very clear data, and before you know it, you're doing the 40 shades of blue
kind of
design process that you really don't want to end up in that.
I have 26 button heights.
Yeah. I just find that when you start just dealing in large numbers, it feels like you're getting insights, and you're dealing with the majority, but people will slip through the cracks. Like, people slip through the cracks of those large numbers. So it's easier to dismiss things as edge cases when you see them as, oh, it's less than 1% of users, but they're still people. And so there's this tension, I think, between the power you get from quantitative data and analytics and trying to remain user-centered and trying to ensure that nobody gets left behind.
Right. Certainly that 1% of users might be people that have like a compelling need for your product or whatever it is you're doing.
Exactly. Because, you know, it might turn out that, you know, oh, only 1% of users are on a particular platform or browser or network, but they might be part of this demographic that accounts for 50% of your sales. Mm-hmm. So it's tricky to, or could be accounting for 50% of your sales if they weren't being, you know, if they weren't falling through the cracks. So the numbers game is a tricky one. I think it's, you always need to kind of temper it with something more qualitative.
So, I mean, that qualitative safety net that you sort of build in to catch those people that fall through the cracks, or maybe even to look at first before you ever filter that through the lens of insights and analytics, and that more quantitative process, like, what does that look like for you guys? Like, how does that qualitative research really, really function either to make sure nobody gets left behind or to make sure they're included in the first place, ideally?
Well, there's different means of you know, not forgetting about this stuff. Design principles, I always find, could be really useful if you've encoded into your design principles things like inclusivity. Then you should be running every design decision past your design principles and measuring them against them. And if they're not coming up to scratch, then that's a way of sort of catching yourself. Yeah, there's a way of thinking about it that by starting, as you said, from the stress cases, I don't like to say edge cases, let's say the stress cases, that the final result will be better for it. Because this is the fundamental idea of inclusive design, that if you're thinking of the you know, the stress case of someone who's trying to use your product in difficult circumstances, then if you can meet that need, then what you'll have designed and built will be something that's more robust and more resilient for everybody, precisely because you considered the outlier less than 1% cases mm-hmm. when you were building it. So it's, you know, there's an element of, I think it's in coding, they call it like monkey coding or something, chaos monkey or something, where you, like, you deliberately break parts of a thing and see how your code holds up. Like there's something to be said for in your design process, even if you don't have demographics for people in those situations, to invent it, to say, okay, what if somebody is in this really tough situation? What if somebody's got this, you know, particular technology, particular situation, and design with that in mind, just because it'll make something more robust in the end.
Totally. And actually, it's interesting, as you know, two people that work in agency, when we build products for our customers, one of the things that we're really trying to instill in our development team is don't start with that base case. Start with that you know, stress case. Start with that miserable path. And walk the miserable path first, because that's how you create a better base case. And so thinking about, you know, that person that has a low bandwidth system. And so, like, as you're doing development, check the low bandwidth option in Firefox or whatever to simulate like what 3G looks like. Or what's worse, have to make it work in IE11 with Windows 7 first. And that actually saves us a ton of time on the backside, where most of the time you're like, okay, I built this great experience in this base case. Now I got to go and do all this other work to like make it work in all of these other stress cases. And, you know, that tends to be a lot of finishing at the end. And if you do all of that work up front, you have a better product for it.
I totally agree. And I think it's, on the one hand, it's kind of like a superpower that devs can think of these questions. On the other hand, it does contribute to this cliche of the developers always being the misery guts who are bringing up stuff and going, oh, no, you can't do that, and oh, you shouldn't do that. But I think you want a good developer involved in the design process really early on, before anything goes near code, precisely because of that, precisely because they are good at asking those questions that begin, what if? Mm-hmm. What if this happens? What if that isn't supported? What if somebody isn't seeing the page, right? And it's being read aloud to them. All of these are great what if questions. And if you can get that into the design process early on, then yeah, the resulting design will be better. Or even when, you know, a good developer, I think, when they're presented with an interface element, let's say, you know, they've been told you're going to code up this this pattern. Here's how it looks. I think a good developer has what the Filament Group called the X-ray vision, mm-hmm. where you kind of look beneath the surface detail of, okay, it's these particular colors and these particular shapes, but what does it do? What's it for, right? And you answer that fundamental question, oh, it's for choosing an option from a list of options. And then, and this goes back to what we were talking earlier about choosing the right HTML for the job, mm-hmm. then now that you've used your X-ray vision to look below the component to find its fundamental purpose, you then choose the minimal viable technology to enable that purpose. Maybe it's a select element or something. Now, the crucial thing is you don't stop there. Mm-hmm. You then go on and you layer on, you know, the extras until you start to get it up to the fidelity of what the design is asking for. But then you've got the best of both worlds. You've got something that in the end result looks like it's supposed to look, behaves like it's supposed to behave for the majority use case. But in the unanticipated situations, it can, you know, break down into something usable, into something that's not perfect, it's not ideal, it doesn't look like it's supposed to, but it still works. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you start just with this is the perfect visual presentation, this is the perfect behavior, and we're building that, then it only works in the perfect situation.
Exactly.
As soon as that situation goes away, it's like a facade. It's almost like a building being propped up with wood behind it, and you've just taken away the struts.
No, definitely. And it doesn't make things robust. I think that's a big part of it, right? Is when you think about, like, in relating this back to a design system, like, how do I make my design system bulletproof? Because that is going to be everywhere. Lots of different products typically consume a design system. It's less common, I think, for a design system to exist just for a single product. And so when you think about, like, the reuse of those patterns and where those things go, you want them to have all that underlying thoughtfulness in them, because you have a lot of use cases that you just can't anticipate.
Yeah, I think those are the what if questions that come up the most in regards to design systems is how the different components interact with one another. And this is often the bit that's missing from the documentation of a design system. I'm like, here's the individual components, but what's missing is maybe the system part that says only use this between 2 and 3 times on a page, but no more. Mm-hmm. Or this component should never follow that component. Or, you know, just rules like that that take care of the glue, the how things stick together, rather than just, oh, here's the individual component. So trying to keep that big picture in mind.
Right. And that thing that basically, instills that wisdom of like, you can use a grid and you can use a hero, but you probably shouldn't make a grid of heroes.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
It's an interesting sort of take on this, right? Like talking about how you start on this miserable path and start with those stress cases. It reminds me a lot of the conversation around test-driven development and the idea of having all these base case tests that exist ahead of time that you know are failing, because the idea is that it makes you build better software when you think about those test cases in mind and you continue to remind yourself of that purpose of that thing that you're building. Do you see any parallels there too?
Definitely. But it's this funny thing with test-driven development is that when I hear about it and I read about it, it resonates completely for exactly the reasons you just said. It's like, yes, you're starting almost with the minimum viable thing. Does it pass this test? And then you build up and you layer on. Totally makes sense to me. In practice, I've never done test-driven development, but I haven't done development in quite a while, so I'm gonna excuse myself for that. But yeah, the in principle part of test-driven development, I think, matches very well to this idea of identifying the core functionality, and you write the test for the core functionality, kind of pass that, and then you're free to enhance from there. You're free to add extra functionality and make it all bells and whistles, and you can do all sorts of stuff on top. So yeah, there's definitely, I think, a philosophical overlap there. What's missing on my part is the experience and knowledge to actually do test-driven development.
No, and fundamentally, it's hard to get it to work inside of organizations, especially at scale, largely because of the structure of most of those organizations' teams. And so when you think about, like, when do you write that test case, right? Like, you don't write that test case when you have a high fidelity design in front of you. You start to write that test case when you have a user story.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see if designers took on the philosophical ideas of test-driven development and applied it to design. Like, what's the minimum viable thing this component is going to need to have in it? And make sure it's got that, and then, you know, go crazy after that, add whatever you want, but just make sure it's got that minimum viable part in.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this is the thing that I hope this, like, nascent idea of design ops actually solves inside of our world is, you know, in that digital creation process, one of the really hard parts is that there is so much more to design than making pictures of websites. And any designer will tell you it's not just about how it looks, it's also how it works. It's also how it relates to this user need. It's also all of the research that's behind it. So much of that is lost in that handoff process to a developer, where all a developer is receiving is, you know, in a really great case, a nice encapsulated design of something like a card or a tile. And there's so much missing in that handoff and that trade-off that I really hope that this concept of design ops just seizes on and really tries to solve that problem.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, because, you know, you mentioned organizations, and that's where the challenge is. That is so true. And I think that as technical people, we try to gravitate towards technical solutions. And partly that is because, frankly, technical solutions are easier than human solutions. Mm-hmm. It's easier to code your way out of a problem than to actually sit people down in a room and figure out the real underlying problem, which can be organizational and structural. We talk about design systems, and often we're talking about the artifacts, right? The components, the code, the visual design. But design ops, which is less visible, I guess, it doesn't really have those artifacts. It's the how things are done. In a way, that's really the system part, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, a pattern library by itself isn't a design system. A style guide isn't a design system. But once you've got the ops part in there, which is shared understanding and shared knowledge of how things are done and how something goes from idea to execution to life, that almost feels like maybe it's more valuable than the tangible outputs of a design system.
Back in Basalt's early history, one of the things that we ended up working for was a large healthcare company. And we, you know, spent several months working on this big project, launched this amazing pattern library, all this other stuff like that. And at the end of it, our lead on the project says, whew, man, I would have never guessed that it was 80% people and 20% technology. He's like, you know, I would have thought that giving people this beautiful, elegant piece of code as a deliverable, along with all this documentation that explained all the things in it, and having, and I mean, they had a stake in the process, much like you were talking about earlier, but still the organizational change that needed to happen to actually make it all go was the biggest challenge by far that team had to overcome.
Yeah, that's a pattern we see again and again, that it's down to humans, it's down to communication, and don't expect any particular technology to solve those problems. There's no avoiding the hard human problems. Like, so just recently I was writing about design systems, and I made a somewhat provocative jump. I'm not saying I necessarily believe this, but let's say you look at the reasons why. You talk to anyone who's got a design system and they've written about it or they've talked about it and explain why they have one, there's two words come up again and again, and that's consistency and efficiency. See this over and over again. Like, people are wasting time reinventing the wheel when, you know, we only need one of these components and then we can reuse it. But those ideas of consistency and efficiency, they go back a long way in manufacturing processes. And you go back to Taylor and these ideas of, you know, minimizing the waste and being as efficient as possible. Mm-hmm. And there's a long history of dehumanization there. Right, that you're turning people into just cogs in a machine to be the most efficient and consistent way. And so I was kind of throwing out, could a design system be part of this history of dehumanization? Right. And other people have sort of written in response, and Brad Faust kind of pointed out that it could be, but it depends on the organization. And Ethan Marcotte said a similar thing. It's like, yeah, does the design system, is it used in this sort of hammer kind of way to say, you must abide by the design system. You may not deviate from the system. It has been handed down from on high. Or is it a liberating force where it's like, I'm freed up now that we have the design system. I'm freed up to be more expressive in how I design and build because all of this drudge work is taken care and for me and it's been automated away. So ultimately what it comes down to is not whether you have a design system or not. It's what kind of organization are you working at? That really determines, you know, how these things are used.
Yeah, I mean, are you the Ford Motor Co. or are you Tesla, right? You know, and like, not to knock on current day Ford, but I think that, like, you know, Henry Ford is famous for the assembly line, right? And, you know, there's Charlie Chaplin films about, you know, working on an assembly line and everything else like that. And like you said, those sort of dehumanizing aspects. I think that hearkening back to the Industrial Revolution, like, you know, if we're going that way in a digital age, these things are used in one of two ways. They're either used to reduce costs and in such a manner, maybe take a little of the human element out of it, or they're there to enable innovation. And I think that the really tricky part is trying to do both at the same time is very hard. And I don't think that there's like quite a script for that yet.
Yeah, I think you need to pay attention to how people perceive the design system. Do they perceive it as this liberating thing where they're so happy it exists, and they feel, again, do they feel ownership of it? Do they feel like they were part of the creation of it and they're invested in it? Or do they see it as this constraint that it's stifling the creativity and that they'd have to work around it? And if they feel that way, they are going to work around it. The people will find a way, you know, to get something live that isn't in the design system if they feel the design system is there as this kind of constraint they have to work around.
Yeah, or if it's too arcane. I think that's another piece of it too, is that it's possible to load a whole lot of tech into a design system these days. You can make it very, very flexible. You can make it very, very scalable. But if the complexity that introduces into somebody's workflow is untenable for them, then, you know, it's going to get abandoned.
Well, don't get me started, because, I mean, I said I don't do much development these days on client projects. And I have to admit that part of it is because of these processes, the build processes around quote unquote modern web development. I just don't get it, because these are choices we're making. Like, there's nothing inherent in web browsers that says you must have this tool chain of all these different dependencies relying on this and pulling down that. It's like we have collectively decided that we must do this in order to put a website live. And sometimes I've been in that situation where I literally just wanted to change one line. Maybe it's one line of CSS, or maybe it's a label on a form element, and the yak shaving commences, and I've got to install this and the NPM that and the webpack or whatever it is we're using these days. And I can't take it anymore. So I'm out of anything involving those kind of tool chains, because it doesn't make sense. In the same way that what we were talking about earlier and trying to find the minimum viable functionality of something, I think you kind of want to have the minimum viable tool chain. Like, what's the least you need to have in order to get this thing live, rather than the premature optimization that we seem to be doing these days?
Like, I understand the necessity of a lot of like build tools and all that sort of thing. But I think that like it does feel like a cornice, right? Like, every time you add another level of complexity, you're out a little further on this ledge that is a barrier to understanding, a barrier to adoption. And I think that, you know, again, this human problem of how do you actually make design systems withstand the test of time, it's fundamentally getting people to use them. And so those barriers are things that you then have to work extra hard to overcome when you're looking at adoption.
Completely. I think, you know, we use the term dependency, which I don't see as a positive term, right? Mm-hmm. I think you want to reduce dependencies, and yet most built tool chains seem to have a lot of them. And if we could reduce the dependencies, then you're increasing the access, the number of people who could edit, add, tweak a component in your design system would increase if the number of dependencies were decreased. That's I believe it's, you know, Occam's razor, you know, don't necessarily multiply entities. I feel like we've multiplied entities an awful lot in our tool chains.
It's interesting. Like, we end up doing a fair amount of client work that is literally just dependency mapping. Let me understand all the things that are required for me to like build software. And oftentimes it's a pretty insane amount of stuff. And trying to make sure that all of those things don't incur any points of failure along the way can be really challenging and really hard to navigate if you're not deeply familiar with how the system works.
Yeah, I mean, I've run workshops on kind of evaluating technologies, and I have found that certain things to ask. One is, how well does it fail? Like, it's most people will ask, how well does it work when they see, you know, a tool or something being promoted, being said, hey, you need this tool, and say, oh, well, how well does it work? But the question you need to ask is, how well does it fail? Mm-hmm. If I use this tool and it fails, would it fail gracefully? Will I still be able to push my code live? Will I be able to do what I need to do? And then asking as well questions like, who benefits from this? Mm-hmm. Is this something that's going to make my life as a developer easier because I'll have to type less, for example? Okay, that's fine. But if the cost is, but the end user needs to download, you know, more scripts now because you benefit. This is particularly in the case of tools that are shipped, you know, with your code. Like, if you use a CSS framework like Bootstrap or something like Foundation, you get a benefit as the developer, but the user pays a price. Mm-hmm. So it's benefited you, the user pays a price in just the download of that framework. And you can argue that, you know, anything that saves the developer time is therefore helping the user because they're working better, more efficiently, faster. Mm-hmm. But I think when it comes to stuff that directly touches the user, and that's really in terms of what you're shipping down the wire to the end user, I think you need to apply much more stringent rules about that and really justify the use of any of those tools.
Yeah, I mean, that argument of, hey, making sure that I have great developer tools and making the user pay the cost because that means my developers scale faster, that feels pretty hollow, because there's ways around doing that that don't necessarily have an impact or a cost to a user. And thinking about the way that you look at dependencies and the way that you look at build tools and the way you look at all of these things together, really understanding like what the complexity of that is, what the performance impact of that is, what the human impact of it is in terms of adoption. Like, we have ways of thinking about these things and being mindful and thoughtful of our intention behind these tools, like you said.
We do. I do feel that they need to be, if not easy, they need to be the default way. So a good example. So we got all these tools we use on our own computers, and they don't affect the end user in any way. We have version control, we have package managers, all this stuff. Doesn't affect the user. And then, like I said, you've got the tools that directly affect the end user, like a CSS library like Bootstrap, or a JavaScript framework. Mm-hmm. You know, you're shipping jQuery, you're shipping React. Now, sometimes there's the option, actually, we're using React, for example, because we love the modularity. We love the way that we can break things down into components. But we don't actually care whether these components are generated in the browser at runtime by JavaScript on the user's device, or we generate them ahead of time and ship them as HTML. Mm-hmm. So let's, you know, I would say in that situation, always, always, always favor, you know, the pre-rendering ahead of time. And it is possible to do that, but it's not definitely not the default way. You know, as in, like, if you're just creating a React app from start, from scratch, you read how to do that. The default assumption is to push it all down to the user's device. And you have to do a bit of extra work to make it your problem,
right,
if you see what I mean, rather than the user's problem. And I do think it's important that the path of least resistance should be the path that favors the user while still, you know, keeping the developer happy.
No, I think that's a really strong statement, is looking at stuff like that and, you know, basically saying if the path of least resistance is focused on the user, I think that that's maybe not an axiom to live by, but certainly one that you should keep it at the top of your mind as you're building these digital products.
Oh, I mean, I very much have, I guess, principles that I apply to almost every project. So we're talking about design principles early in projects, you know, they're project specific design principles. But I think when it comes to design and development, especially on the web, there are some universal ones. I mentioned Occam's razor, don't unnecessarily multiply entities. That's a classic. Postel's law, the robustness principle, be conservative in what you send, be liberal in what you accept, mm-hmm. right? So be conservative in what you send. That's what you send down to the wire. Like, do you really need to be sending that image? Do you really need to be sending that JavaScript library? But then be liberal in what you accept. Don't turn users away because of the device they're using or the browser or the network. Be liberal in what you accept. And then the other one that ties very much into what we're talking about with that X-ray vision and minimum viable component is the principle of least power, which sounds counterintuitive, but it says choose the least powerful language suitable for a given task. This is actually a principle that was underlying the World Wide Web itself. Tim Berners-Lee applied the principle of least power. And it sounds counterintuitive because you think you want to use the most powerful language, mm-hmm. but the most powerful language comes with all the extra fragility that comes with, you know, that comes with power. So now you're doing everything in JavaScript and I just want to change some CSS. You have to do it in JavaScript or you got to send all that JavaScript down to the client. So, you know, just choosing the right tool for the job. If something can be done in CSS, do it in CSS. If the classic example is, you're adding all these ARIA roles to your components, mm-hmm. but maybe you don't need them because you could just use a button rather than adding role equals button to a div, right? So use the principle of least power. It's almost like reducing dependencies.
Well, that's really great. So one of the reasons why we wanted to talk about this podcast was to talk a little bit more about progressive web apps. And you know, while we touched on it, we haven't exactly dove into that in any real detail. Talk to me about some of the awesome work that you're doing there, because I think it is very related to this, even though we haven't addressed it directly.
Yeah, so progressive web apps, I mean, first, just give a definition. It's, in my opinion, it's very simple from a technical point of view. A website that's running on HTTPS, it has a web app manifest, a JSON file of metadata, and it has a service worker. And that's where the powerful stuff happens. But while I'm really drawn to this technology of the service worker is that it does allow you to take care of some of those scenarios that aren't the perfect situation. Mm-hmm. When people do have flaky network connections or no network connection at all, that you could still provide an experience to them, that you're able to give some kind of fallback. Oh, you're offline, but here's, you know, this article you were reading earlier, or you're offline, but here's the minimum information you need to know. So I'm very drawn to it precisely because I like to think of this kind of X-ray vision looking beneath the surface way of, you know, like you say, the happy path and seeing like, yeah, but what if?
Right.
What if there's no internet connection? And, you know, for the longest time, that would have been a nonsensical question to even ask in terms of web development. What if there's no internet connection? Mm-hmm. But now with service workers, we can actually answer the question. We can say, we can say, if there's no internet connection, let's do this or let's try that. Let's look in the cache. So it really appeals to me. I will say one thing. I don't know about you, but I find things like adding a service worker or a web app manifest or even, I don't know, a favicon, the kind of things that sometimes slip between the cracks in design systems.
Definitely. I feel like service workers are this incredible safety net that is so often ignored as a part of building a web application, where you were talking earlier about how does a thing fail and does it fail the right way? I think that there's such an unbelievable safety net. I have a hard time thinking of a design system that I touch on a regular basis that has these included in it.
I think maybe that's because it's kind of invisible, right? Mm-hmm. You can't point to a service worker and say, we've designed a service worker and it looks like this, because it's entirely behavior. It's entirely scenarios. If this happens, then we'll do that. So how can you even put that in the design system?
So we've actually thought a lot about stuff like this, where there's this idea of a higher order component, right? So you take a component and that is just a container for other components. And that container can take some sort of action. It can, you know, measure analytics. It can, you know, have a service worker. It can look at accessibility. It can do performance-based testing. All of these different ideas of I just want a container of code that is able to do something interesting to all the components inside of it.
So it doesn't necessarily have a visual output.
Correct. There's no visual representation of it. And so in a section of your design system, it's just documentation about what that component does. But when you're actually coding a thing and you're gluing all these components together, it's part of your toolbox. And so that is really kind of a helpful way of thinking about all these things that don't have a visual state attached to them, as you think about them as this order of component that exists to do a job, but not to show a thing.
Yeah. I think it'd be important to get that into the process early on when you're, when you've got jobs and Trello or Jira or whatever, and instead of it being, oh, it's moving from design into development, and there's this, it's easy to test because you can see it looks right and you can see it behaves right. And it's much tougher when it's stuff like this that you're describing where it doesn't have a visual representation. But yeah, it should be absolutely a task in the Kanban board.
Totally. And oftentimes we see this with APIs. So we obviously work in a ton of microservices environments, and we almost look at a design system as like a service experience, right? And so it is a web service that is all of your experiences encapsulated, that you can just make requests via an API and grab them. And so, it's not as simple as that, but that's kind of how we view it. And as a part of that, you want to have components inside of your design system that are able to make other API requests to other microservices and get data from them that is potentially business logic, potentially impacts the way that components that it surrounds behave. And so that's kind of where the concept came from, was this idea of how do we attach to other APIs in this ecosystem. And I think that while we haven't done it, including that as an avenue for a service worker seems like a really powerful idea.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting challenge.
Well, anyway, I wanted to say I really appreciate you coming on today and talking. This has been an awesome conversation. It's great to get your insight and your take on, the miserable path, looking at those stress cases, looking at the ways of making us build better software and the design process and the human processes that go into that. So I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me, Chris.
That's all for today. We'd love to hear from you with questions, ideas for new episodes, beer recommendations, or comments. You can find us on Twitter at @TheDSPod. Cheers, and thanks for listening to the Design Systems Podcast.